Good evening. So this evening we're engaging with the question, can Christianity be proved? I think for most Londoners, and indeed perhaps many of you in this room this evening, I would suspect that the default answer to this question is no. You might say, well, it's a nice story. Perhaps there are some comforting ideas implicit within the Christian story, but it's not something that has basis in fact. Actually, for many, I suspect, the reason they would say this, behind this, is the default assumption of naturalism. Naturalism, put simply, is the idea that really the only thing we can be confident of, the only thing we can be confident exists, is that which we can perceive with our five senses. Physicist Stephen Barr defines it as nothing exists except matter, and that everything in the world must therefore be the result of strict mathematical laws of physics, and you might add biology and chemistry and other natural sciences, and blind chance. This means that when we talk about proving something, most of us think about the scientific method, the process of experimentation and generation of provable, replicable results. And some would say, actually, outside of this domain, outside of the scientific method, it's really impossible to know if anything is true. And religion is about as far outside of the scientific method as is humanly possible. So for some, this question is really a non-starter, because you can't really prove a supernatural claim like God exists. If the scientific method tells us how, then religion is at best a well-meaning speculation as to the question of why. Now, whilst I would agree that the Christian faith cannot be proven in a strict scientific sense, this evening I want to show you that Christianity can be shown to be true based on the historical evidence. At its heart, the Christian faith is a claim about the person of Jesus, that he walked the earth 2,000 years ago, that he healed the sick and raised the dead, that he redefined right and wrong, that he died a death on behalf of humanity, and 3 days later, he was resurrected. He came back from the dead and then ascended into heaven. Now, clearly, these are claims that have huge spiritual implications. If Jesus did rise from the dead, then we can believe in a God who created the universe and has the power to bring people life from the dead. But these are also historical claims about a person who walked the earth 2,000 years ago. Last week, I was on a holiday in Israel, and on Thursday, I was in Jerusalem. I don't know how much you know about the Bible, but essentially a lot of the events of the New Testament are based around the country that we now call Israel. And I was in Jerusalem, and as we were walking around the ruins of Herod's palace. Herod was the king who was the king of Israel at the point of Jesus' birth. And as we went up the top of one of the towers that Herod had built, and at the top of, as I was on top of Herod's tower, as I looked ahead, I could see the Mount of Olives, the location where Jesus prayed before he was crucified. As I looked to my left, I could see the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the church which marks the location where Jesus is said to have died and been buried. And really what I'm arguing here is the New Testament is not described in a vacuum. They're historical claims about a real person who really lived in a real place. And Christians are really simply people who look at the evidence for Jesus' life, his death and his resurrection, and say, that's true. I'm convinced that happened and that Jesus is who he says he is. And then make a choice to follow him with their whole lives. Really, the basis for my argument this evening is nothing more complex than the historical method. This is simply the idea that you can use evidence to weigh up the different arguments and conclusions and make a judgment about which is the most credible conclusion about what's happened in the past. This is something we all believe in. Take the Holocaust, something that we believe all happened, something we all believe happened. Actually, many of us find the arguments that the Holocaust deniers put forward spurious and perhaps even offensive. And yet for many of us, we haven't met Holocaust survivors, and we certainly weren't there at the time. We believe it happened because we trust the historians who've assessed the evidence, who've collated the eyewitness testimony, who've gone through the archives and proved using the evidence, and so we're convinced. You might say, well, yes, that's a very recent past. It's something we have lots of evidence for. But actually, I don't think any of us would doubt that Julius Caesar existed, that he invaded Britain in the first century BC, or Alexander the Great, one of the most impressive military generals in all of history, who conquered much of Asia in the 3rd century BC. Ironically, there's probably less robust evidence for the existence of Julius Caesar or Alexander the Great than Jesus himself. But we believe and we use the historical method each day. I don't know if there are any lawyers in the room, but actually I think this is very similar to a legal argument. At a trial, we ask a defense and a prosecution to present competing accounts of what happened. And then we ask a jury to decide on the basis of the evidence to make a judgment on which account is the most credible account of what happened. We're so confident of this method that we're willing to incarcerate someone in prison for the rest of their life on the basis of that jury's assessment of what happened, at their decision of which account is most supported by the facts. And that's what I want to invite you to do this evening, to consider the evidence that I'm going to place before you and decide which of the competing conclusions about the identity of Jesus is the most credible. Now, before I do that, I wonder if for some of you, it feels like this whole approach is wrong. When it comes to spiritual experience, for some of you, you might say, the question is not, is it true, but does it help you? Is it effective? I think for many in our generation, I'm looking around, you're basically all millennials like myself. For many in my generation, they would say for a spiritual experience to be valid, it doesn't have to be true. You can see this in the way that many of us have adopted a smorgasbord of different spiritual practices like yoga and meditation and mindfulness. And do you remember the Kabbalist strings that Madonna and others wore? We adopted these different spiritual practices actually without adopting the worldview that sits behind those. And it's possible actually that we've adopted a number of practices that have different worldviews that sit behind them. Actually, there's all proof that really what we value these practices for is for their utility rather than for their truthfulness. So some might say, in answer to this question, well, no, you can't prove Christianity any more than you can prove any other spiritual worldview, but in a sense, it doesn't really matter. That's not the point. What matters is whether it satisfies you. Now, I can understand why some of you would say that. I imagine some of you are on the outside looking in at Christianity. And when you're on the outside looking in, I suspect you're probably asking, well, does it accord with the evidence? Is it true? But you also want to understand, what does it say? Actually, for what it's worth, I'm convinced, as well as being true to the facts, the Christian faith is real in our experience. It speaks right into our deepest desires. At the heart of the Christian story is the claim that God has come to earth in the person of Jesus, that God has walked among us. Actually, I think this speaks into our deepest desires. It speaks to our desire for reason, to understand why. As you are almost certainly aware, last week with Stephen Hawking's death, some of his famous quotes came to light. And I read this quote on why the universe exists, on finding out the answer to why the universe exists. He said, if we find an answer to that, it would be the ultimate triumph of human reason, for then we would know the mind of God. Now, I'm not suggesting that Stephen Hawking was anything but an atheist, but I'm saying that from the most intelligent scientist to the smallest child, regardless of our spiritual worldview, we want to understand why. We want to make sense of the human experience. And actually, Jesus, in entering into our world, makes the claim that he can come and be the voice that explains human experience, to be the one who shows us and gives us an answer to the question of why we're here, to actually show us that we find our deepest purpose in relationship with him. I think the Christian story also speaks to our desire to be loved. I don't think anyone would deny that at the center of the human experience, we all desire to be loved and to love. And at the center of the Christian narrative, the very reason for why Jesus comes to earth is out of love for humankind. One of, if not the central truth of the Christian faith, is that if you are loved, that you are loved by the one who made you. He loves you so much that he was willing to die for you, that you might be reunited with the God who created you. Actually, I became a Christian when I was 20 years old at university 10 years ago. And I can promise you that I found nothing more experientially satisfying than the knowledge that I'm loved by God. When I wake up in the morning and I know that I'm loved by God, that gives me such a life belt to approach life, all the travails, all the difficulties of life, knowing that actually I'm already loved by God. Actually, it's probably, I would argue, that either Christianity is the most attractive lie in the universe or it's true. And that's what we're going to decide tonight. I think also the Christian faith speaks to our fear of death. We don't like to talk about it, but I think we hate, deep down inside ourselves, we hate the idea that our existence will end. Ernst Becker, a secular psychologist and philosopher, wrote in 1974 in his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Denial of Death, a brilliant quote that I think describes this in great detail. The idea of death, the fear of it, haunts the human animal like nothing else. It is the mainspring of human activity, activity designed largely to avoid the fatality of death, to overcome it by denying in some way that it is the final destiny of man. And the Christian story speaks right into this fear. Jesus' claim is that he came to bring an end to death, to bring eternal life for those who trust him and follow him. That just as Jesus triumphed over death in his resurrection, so he has promised to bring an end to his death, to death for his followers. They, like him, will be raised one day when he returns to judge the living and the dead. So if this is true, Jesus answers our greatest desires to understand why we exist, to avoid death, and to know that we are loved. But of course, all of this relies on the premise that he is who he says he is. Either the claims that Jesus makes are true, and it's of infinite importance, so much so that it would lead to, no, even require you to change your life. Or they're not true, and you can ignore everything he has to say. The whole institution of the church is pointless, and I, who started working for the church 6 months ago, should give it up tomorrow. Actually, even Paul, the New Testament teacher, agrees with me. He said, if Christ has not been raised, i.e. the resurrection didn't happen, then our preaching is in vain and your faith is in vain. If in this life only we have hoped in Christ, we are all, of all people, most to be pitied. He's saying, if this isn't true, we've believed in vain. There's literally no point to it. Actually, if this is true, you should be pitying. You should be feeling sorry for us. If you're here with your Christian friend, you're not a Christian, you should feel sorry for us if this isn't true. That we've wasted our life on this. And this is one of the earliest, most significant Christian teachers saying, if this isn't true, it's all a waste of time. So this evening, we must ask the question, or must answer the question even, what does the evidence point to? Who is Jesus? I want to suggest to you that there are three alternatives that almost everyone in the room will identify with. Fiction, legend, or Lord. Fiction, that Jesus never existed, that he's a total fabrication. Legend, or you might say myth, that there was some point in history, a Middle Eastern teacher known as Jesus who taught some interesting things. Perhaps he was an enlightened teacher. But after his death, this historical figure was exaggerated by his followers, that he was ultimately portrayed as much more than he ever was. Actually, they distorted and exaggerated his claims to the point where they claimed that he was God in the flesh. And thirdly, that he's Lord, that he is who he said he is, that he is God in the flesh. I think those are the three options that the vast majority of people will fall into. Either he's totally fictional, totally true, or somewhere in between. There's some truth there, but actually it got distorted and exaggerated. I briefly want to take you through these three options. I want to show you the evidence, both secular and from the biblical accounts. I want to show you that actually I think it points to the third option, that this is the most credible conclusion that we can make. And though we can't scientifically prove it, I think the evidence supports the idea that Jesus is who he said he is, that he is God in the flesh. So first of all, Jesus is total fiction then. You may have heard the arguments that challenge the very existence of Jesus and say, well, he never really existed. Or maybe you've even wondered yourself, well, what is even the evidence that this man walked the earth? Actually, I would suggest that of the three scenarios, this is the most unlikely. Even if we leave aside the accounts of Jesus' life from the New Testament, there is a wealth of secular historians and some of his contemporaries who show us, give us proof, evidence for Jesus' existence. I want to highlight just two for you because of time. First is Tacitus, and the second is Josephus. Tacitus is generally recognized as one of the finest Roman historians, and his historical work, Annals, I knew I was going to say that the wrong way. His historical work, I won't even try and attempt, is acknowledged as our best information about this period. Tacitus was writing AD 56 to 120, so he's basically writing the next generation after Jesus' death in AD 33. So he's writing within the first generation of followers after Christ. And he describes a fire in AD 64 in Rome, and Nero, the emperor, is blamed for it. But in order to divert attention from himself, Nero blames the emerging Christian community. This is what he says. Nero fastened his guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. Immediately you can see this guy's not a neutral source. He's not pro-Christian. He's very much anti-Christian. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate. And the most mischievous superstition broke out in Judea and even in Rome. Accordingly, an arrest was made of all who pleaded guilty, that upon their information, an immense multitude was convicted, not so much of the crime of firing the city as of hatred against mankind. It's one of the earliest recorded secular historians describing the Christian movement. It's actually quite incredible when you look at it. First of all, his account of what happened to Jesus exactly matches up with the New Testament account. It describes him as having suffered the most extreme penalty. If you're familiar at all with the Christian story, you'll know that he's talking about the crucifixion. And that's such an extreme form of murder, of killing citizens in the Roman Empire, that in fact they wouldn't permit it to happen to their own citizens. This is an extremely gruesome way to die. Mentioned that it happened under Pontius Pilate. Again, just a cursory review of the New Testament will see that matches up, that it's Pontius Pilate who ultimately sends him to be crucified. It describes an immense multitude. This is AD 64, less than 30, or just 30 years after Jesus' death and, as I would claim, his resurrection. But already 30 years after his death, Jesus has a large following, including in Rome. Again, something that's attested to in the New Testament. In one of the letters, is to the fledgling Christian community in Rome. And these people are willing to die rather than recant their faith. Again, this, you see this pattern all the way through. As Roman governors are complaining about Christians, they're often saying they won't even recant their faith. They won't deny it. And this guy's hardly a positive source. He describes it as the most mischievous superstition. Other secular accounts follow the same pattern, not positively, but describing the person of Christ and the devotion of his followers. Josephus is the other source I want to draw to your attention. And he's the principal Jewish historian from the same period. He describes how Ananias, the high priest, killed James, the brother of Jesus. He said, he commenced a meeting of the Sanhedrin, the ruling council, and brought before them a man named James, the brother of Jesus, who was called the Christ. The accused, and he accused them of having transgressed the law and delivered them up to be stoned. Again, a recognition that this man, Jesus, was recognized as the Messiah, the one sent by God. And his followers were willing to die for this belief. And really, this is just the tip of the iceberg. But there is such a wealth of evidence. It's so convincing that almost no historian of this period or theologian, irrespective of their own beliefs, questions Jesus' existence. Bart Ehrman, a skeptical agnostic New Testament scholar, puts it like this. The reality is that every single author who mentions Jesus, talking about the contemporaries, pagan, Christian, or Jewish, was fully convinced that at least he lived. Even the enemies of the Jesus movement thought so. Even among their many slurs against the religion, his non-existence is never one of them. Jesus certainly existed. So if we're convinced then that he's not fiction, we must then ask, is he just a myth? Is he just a legend? Let's turn to the idea that he is a myth or legend. Now, I think actually this idea takes it to a number of different forms. But essentially, they all go something like this. Jesus was a maybe effective moral teacher. He's a spiritual leader who gathered something of a following. Maybe an enlightened teacher who had some brilliant ideas that were ahead of his time. But ultimately, he was just a man, not God in the flesh. But after his death, his followers then bring about some new claims. They start to distort the historical figure into this myth, this legend who claims not just to be a man, but actually claims to be God. There are a number of different manifestations of this idea. Think about the Da Vinci Code. That's probably one of the most famous in relatively recent times. It claims that Jesus is like just a normal guy who married Mary Magdalene. He claims that Constantine, the Roman Empire emperor, in about 300 AD, suppressed the other accounts of Jesus' life that suggested that he wasn't God, but actually more like a prophet or a spiritual leader, because he wanted to create a divine figure that could unite the Roman Empire. Or another one is Philip Pullman. I can't remember the series of fiction books he's written, but he's a very famous author. And he's written a book, The Good Man Jesus and the Scoundrel Christ. He basically describes the idea of an innocent teacher who's just kind of trying to help people, who then gets distorted to be claimed to be more than that, claimed to be this mythical Christ. I think many of you may be attracted to these accounts because at first sight, they sound plausible. We're all familiar with the idea of exaggeration and distortion. We can think of figures in history who have been whose achievements and identity have been exaggerated. I mean, I know it's a bit trite, but think about Father Christmas. St. Nicholas in the 4th century was a bishop who had a reputation for helping the poor and giving out gifts to help people. But over time, different details get added, and suddenly we're presented with this idea of Father Christmas that obviously we don't recognize as reality, but you get the idea, this pattern of exaggeration and creating these mythical figures who have some root in reality, but ultimately have been distorted. Well, this might appeal to you because it allows you to embrace something of the historical facts, say, well, yeah, no, I recognize he existed, but without having to believe the more outlandish claims that Jesus makes about himself. Or even, if I'm being a bit cheeky, it might say this allows you to take the good bits, the bits of the teaching, for example, that you like from Jesus. You say, when he says, oh, it's fantastic when he says, love your neighbor as yourself, or forgive those who persecute you. but you don't have to allow this to change your life. You can look at the bits where he claims to be God in the flesh and he calls you to follow him and say, no, no, that's embellishment. I like the teaching, but the stuff where he claims to be God, where it's going to have an impact on my life, that bit, that's made up. Well, regardless of whether the precise details of both these claims or indeed why we're attracted to them, I think these different narratives have one implicit assumption within them. And that's that the gospel accounts of Jesus' life cannot be trusted. The gospel accounts of Jesus' life cannot be trusted. To believe these alternative histories, you have to believe that the gospel accounts, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the four found in the New Testament, are unreliable historical sources. Because the gospel accounts present a very different type, very different picture of Jesus than this just this man who's kind of a good teacher. Actually, Jesus is unequivocal that he is the Son of God, that he is God in the flesh on earth. He says, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. He's saying, if you've seen me, you've seen God. He claims that he was there before anything else existed, and through him, the world was created. These are not the claims of a mere man. Jesus in the Gospels is clear that he is divine, to be worshipped. So for you to believe these alternative narratives, you have to say, well, the Gospels, they're not really credible historical sources. And there's probably two things that support that for us. One is people will say, well, you can't really trust them because you can't really be certain of what they said. You know, aren't they just basically copies of copies of copies which have been translated multiple times? So we can't really be sure what the originals ever said. Although others might say, well, you know, they're not eyewitness accounts. Aren't they just latter-day accounts written hundreds of years after the event? We can't really rely on them in any way as kind of a historical source that tells us about what actually happened. I think most people accept these ideas because actually they're not familiar with the evidence. So if we say, what does the evidence say? Actually, rather than being spurious, it's quite the opposite. Actually, we find that these are reliable eyewitness accounts that can be trusted. There's both comprehensive manuscript evidence that gives us a confidence that what we're reading today in the Bible is the same as what was written 2,000 years ago. And because when we look at them, when we actually go inside the Gospels, we can see by what's written that they have the authentic ring, they have the taste of being genuine, authentic eyewitness accounts. First of all, the manuscript evidence then. The wealth of manuscripts and the short period of time from when the Gospels were written and the copies that we have gives me a lot of confidence that we can be very sure of what they said. Peter Kenyon, the director of the British Museum, said, in no other case is the interval of time between the composition of the book and the date of the earliest manuscripts so short as in that of the New Testament. Tacitus, for example, the Roman historian we were talking about earlier, wrote in the first century. The first manuscripts we have of his writing are from the 9th and the 11th century. There's a gap of 800 years between when he wrote and the first manuscripts that we have. Josephus, who wrote in the first century, the first manuscripts we have of him are in the 4th century, and then the next manuscript after that is the 10th, 11th, and 12th centuries. Talking about gaps of hundreds of years, talking about a few manuscripts that we've got to compare to say what did they actually originally say. And yet the New Testament makes those things pale into insignificance. There are 5,000 surviving manuscripts of the New Testament in Latin and Greek, which means we can be very confident of what the original said. We can compare those 5,000 manuscripts and be able to say, what did the original say? Actually, there's a much shorter time difference than any other ancient literature. The Gospels are written generally accepted between 50 and 80 AD. The first manuscript we have is of John's Gospel. It's in the Rylands Library in Manchester, and it's written in 120 AD. So we're talking about a time difference of less than 50 years. Actually, we have the whole New Testament by AD 350. And in between that, we have the New Testament quoted ad nauseum by different Christian writers outside the New Testament. So again, we can see that the New Testament's in circulation. It's being used. It's being accepted well before the first manuscript that we have. The evidence is so compelling that F.F. Bruce, professor at Manchester University, said there is no body of ancient literature in the world which enjoys such a wealth of textual attestation as the New Testament. We can be very confident indeed that what we have in front of us is the same as what was written nearly 2,000 years ago. The second bit was me, but don't worry about it. Furthermore, when you look inside the Gospels themselves, they have all the hallmarks of genuine eyewitness accounts. The vast majority of scholars, regardless of their worldview, will say that will date the Gospels, again, between 50 and 80 AD. They're all written within the lifetime of the first generation of people who followed Jesus. They're written based on the eyewitness testimony of those first followers. So Mark's Gospel is written based on Peter's testimony, one of the first disciples. Now, 50 years might sound like a lot, but you've got to remember this is an oral culture where people didn't write things down a lot of the time, but there was a real practice of learning lots and lots of information and being able to repeat it. In fact, the fact that it was written so shortly after the events that they describe means really the gospel writers are kind of saying, look, this happened, we're so confident of it, we're open to challenge. We're open for anybody else to write, to come along and say, this didn't happen. The people reading the gospel accounts would have been some of the people who were present at the events when they happened. The Gospels even mention real people that would have been known to the readers. Mark chapter 15, verse 21, it says, and then they compelled a passerby, Simon of Cyrene, who was coming in from the country, the father of Alexander and Rufus, to carry his cross. So on the way to Jesus' crucifixion, they get this man, Simon of Cyrene, to carry Jesus' cross. But they mention his sons, Alexander and Rufus. There's no logic to why they would mention his sons. Many other characters in the New Testament are mentioned. They don't go, and this is the person, you know, father of X, Y. Actually, commentators believe that he's referencing Alexander and Rufus, but he's kind of saying, look, if you have any questions about this, if you want to know whether this happened, speak to them. Alexander and Rufus are probably part of the early Christian community. So the fact that he's referencing them is saying, look, this is kind of within the living memory of our community. If you want to ask any questions, you can go and speak to them. And actually, one final mark of authenticity that convinces me that these Gospels are accurate historiographical sources is that they're willing to be very negative about their authors. If these were fake accounts invented, then you'd expect that the people who write them would generally put themselves in a good light. Actually, it's quite the opposite. Think about Mark's Gospel. Peter informed Mark's Gospel. But in that, you have him denying Jesus three times. You have him cutting off the ear of one of the people who comes to arrest Jesus, which Jesus is explicitly against, and even telling Jesus not to be crucified. This has all the hallmarks of an account, which is a transparent account of what happened, warts and all, not hiding anything, rather than a fake account. There's lots more to say on that subject, but suffice it to say, the Gospels are precisely what you'd expect from eyewitness accounts. They reference real people, they're willing to show the failings of their authors, and they're written within the lifetimes of the people who follow Jesus. So I think in the Gospels, then, we have evidence to be able to reject this mythical account for the authentic Jesus, this idea that he's just a teacher who got twisted into this idea of God. Because actually, the evidence that we have in the Gospels is much more comprehensive than any kind of documentary evidence that you might find for those claims. At best, you might have what's called the Gnostic Gospels that are written much later and that aren't accepted by really anybody as authentic accounts of what happened. So if we reject this myth hypothesis, then let's just briefly turn to our third hypothesis before we end, that Jesus is who he said he is. If we're convinced of the authenticity of the gospel accounts, then we have to look within them themselves and say, what do they tell us about this man? Now, I could draw on the prophecies. I could draw on the way that Jesus fulfilled prophecies that were written hundreds of years before his birth. Or I could draw on the fact that he performed amazing miracles, or his teaching that he taught with power, or even his character, his humility and yet his authority, his compassion and yet his willingness to confront evil. But one piece of evidence stands above all of these, and that is the resurrection. It's no coincidence that Paul said, if Christ hasn't been raised, then you've believed in vain. If the resurrection didn't happen, if Jesus is still in Palestine somewhere, his bones rotting in the ground, then you can ignore everything I've said so far. But if Jesus did the impossible, if he was actually raised in physical form despite suffering a cruel death on the cross, then actually you have to respond to him. Now you might say, well, I can believe everything you've said so far, but that is a step too far. Isn't this just against the laws of nature? You know, dead people don't rise. And I say it's precisely the improbability of the event that leads us to the inescapable conclusion that Jesus is who he said he is. It's precisely because it's never happened in history that someone's been in the ground for 3 days and then risen again that means that he must be God in the flesh. So on what basis then, briefly, should you believe the resurrection happened? The first basis is the eyewitness testimony. Whenever, if you're thinking in a trial, what's the best type of evidence? It's eyewitness testimony. And the New Testament is clear that a number of people see Jesus alive after his death. The first witnesses to his resurrection are two women, two Marys. Later, Jesus appears to his close group of disciples. After that, by the time he's ascended into heaven, hundreds of people have witnessed Jesus alive. The New Testament authors want you to be in no doubt that Jesus has been seen by countless witnesses. I mean, different times and in different places. This cannot be some sort of mass hallucination. Even it's not some sort of kind of spiritual ghostly event. He even eats some fish with the disciples to prove that he's physically resurrected. Well, your first objection might be, well, isn't this all just fake? Couldn't this just be made up? Well, actually, the first thing that makes that an improbable reality is who Jesus appears to. The first witnesses to the resurrection are women. Now, if you're in the ancient Middle East and you're fabricating an account, the last thing you would do is make women the first witnesses to the resurrection. Such was the disrespect for women in this culture that women weren't even allowed to give a testimony in court. Even the first critique of Christianity, written in AD 175 by Celsus, tries to discredit the resurrection as being witnessed by a hysterical female. The fact that the women are the first witnesses to the resurrection lends a ring of authenticity. If you were fabricating an account, this isn't who you'd put as the first witnesses. So if this account is true, well, could the disciples just be lying? Well, I'm convinced the disciples weren't lying, primarily because those who made the claim that Jesus rose from the dead were willing to die for that fact, to become martyrs at the hands of the Roman or Jewish authorities. Of the 11 apostles, leaving aside Judas, who followed Jesus, 10 of them would die for following Jesus. One, John died of natural causes, but the other 10, Christian history would tell us, died for following Jesus. And I'm convinced that no one will die for something they don't believe to be true. Now, if someone dies for something, it's not proof that that is true in itself, but it is proof that that person thinks it's true. So the fact that the disciples were willing to die is proof that they believed it was true, that they're not lying. So if it's not a fabricated account and the disciples aren't lying, what's left? Well, some people might suggest it's kind of some sort of spiritual experience, some kind of mass hallucination. Maybe the disciples were kind of almost, they just couldn't believe that Jesus died. So they all together see him reappear. But actually, this kind of thing just doesn't happen. An eminent American psychologist said this about the idea of a mass hallucination. Hallucinations are individual occurrences. By their very nature, only one person can see a given hallucination at a time. They certainly aren't something which can be seen by a group of people. Neither is it possible that one person could somehow induce a hallucination in somebody else. Since a hallucination exists only in this subjective, personal sense, it's obvious that others cannot witness it. What he's saying is the idea that the disciples all experienced a mass hallucination together is just basically impossible. So if we've discounted that this is a fake account, we've discounted the disciples are lying, and we've discounted some kind of mass hallucination or spiritual experience, then I think, however improbable, we must come to the conclusion that the resurrection is the most likely outcome. Author of Sherlock Holmes series, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, said this: when you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. However, even beyond the eyewitness testimony, the historical narrative, what happens both before and after Jesus' death and resurrection, doesn't make sense unless the resurrection happened. Think about the transformation of the disciples. These are Jesus' followers. After the crucifixion, the disciples have clearly lost hope. They're despairing. You know, Peter denies him to the authorities. The leader they followed for 3 years had just been killed, or was about to be killed. They thought he was going to come and save Israel. Actually, he's been killed and publicly humiliated. And yet, fast forward to the book of Acts, the first book which describes the kind of post Jesus' ministry, the beginning of the early church. And the disciples have changed dramatically. They're willing to identify themselves with Jesus. They're proclaiming that he died for humanity. And they're doing it in precisely the place, Jerusalem. They're speaking right in the place where the authorities have just killed Jesus. They've gone back to the place of his accusers and are willing to stand and be associated with Jesus' name. You see such boldness and courage throughout the book of Acts. They're willing to risk their life. It's exactly the opposite of what you'd expect if Jesus had just died. You know, there've been a number of figures in Jewish history around this time in the Roman Empire who came up and kind of built a little bit of a following and got people to follow them. But as soon as they died, their followers just left them, just kind of disappeared into the atmosphere. And yet Jesus is very different. Why is Jesus the exception to this rule? Why does the Jesus movement grow so rapidly after his death? And why are the disciples transformed? The answer, the only answer that we can come to, is the resurrection. Only the sure conviction that their leader and their savior was still alive, actually reigning in heaven and working in them through his spirit, would explain the incredible change in their behavior and the newfound boldness that the disciples experienced. And actually, if you look at the tremendous growth of the church that goes on for the next 300 years, despite all the odds, it's not a state religion, it's an underground sect. They're being killed by both Roman authorities and being stigmatized and persecuted by their Jewish fellow Jews. But if you look at the way the church rapidly explodes, you have to ask why. How is that possible? And I think the only conclusion is that it's possible by the power of the Spirit working in the disciples, leading people to follow them. Tim Keller writes this: nothing in history can be proven the way we prove something in a laboratory. However, the resurrection of Jesus is a historical fact much more fully attested to than most other events of ancient history we take for granted. Every effort to account for the birth of the church apart from Jesus' resurrection flies in the face of what we know about first century history and culture. If you don't short-circuit the process with a philosophical bias against the possibility of a miracle, the resurrection of Jesus has the most evidence for it. So when you put the evidence together, when you consider the eyewitness testimony, you consider the willingness of the disciples to die for the truth, when you consider the way they were changed, and when you consider the way the church exploded, I think the only conclusion we can come to is the resurrection happened. That Jesus was raised from the dead. So where does this leave us? Well, if we're convinced that Jesus isn't fiction, that he isn't a myth, and that he is who he says he is, that he is actually God in the flesh, then I want to draw your attention to something that was written 700 years before Jesus' birth. And it was an Old Testament prophet called Isaiah predicting a coming king. You might have heard it at Christmas. For to us a child is born and a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and of peace, there will be no end. The resurrection isn't just a nice idea. It isn't even just proof that Jesus is who he said he is. It's a It's a vindication of that prophecy. It's a proof that he is the king whose kingdom will have no end, who will live on for eternity. And because he is that king, his life demands your response. Implicit in this recognition of who Jesus is a call for you to recognize him as king, for you to make him king of your life. If it's true, his life demands your worship. Thank you very much.